Public Radio News. It's now 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Earlier this month, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in favor of officials from the town of Greece, New York, and their practice of opening public meetings with a prayer, which was almost always Christian. Two residents had objected to this, saying it violated the First Amendment's Establishment Clause, forbidding government endorsement of any one religion. But the court's majority disagreed, saying the prayers were ceremonial and that the town was not coercing participation by anyone. This ruling got a lot of attention, not just for the prayer issue, but as part of a larger rising debate over religious freedom. Another instance is the Hobby Lobby case, still before the High Court. The owners of this craft store chain sued over the Affordable Care Act's requirement that they provide certain contraception coverage for employees, arguing that doing so would violate their beliefs. Meanwhile, religious freedom's also being debated inside state legislatures, with several considering bills allowing private businesses to refuse services to same-sex couples. Today in The Exchange, revisiting religious freedom. Let's hear from you. What's your take on these most recent debates over religious freedom, and how do you see the country's views changing on this issue? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. We have three guests for the hour joining us from Texas. Hiram Sasser, Director of Litigation at the Liberty Institute, an advocacy and legal defense organization that aims to defend and restore religious liberty in the U.S. Hiram, welcome back. Good to have you.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Also with us, Gilles Bissonnette, staff attorney for the New Hampshire Civil Liberties Union. And Gilles, thank you for coming in. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And also joining us, John Graby, director of UNH Law School's Rudman Center. He teaches constitutional law and civil procedure. And John, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you.
Well, and John, I do want to start with you. What does the Constitution say about religious freedom?
Well, the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution contains a clause known as the Free Exercise Clause, which basically says that Congress shall not interfere with the ability of individuals to freely exercise their religion. The First Amendment also contains a different clause known as the Establishment Clause, which forbids Congress from establishing a religion. And that provision and both provisions have actually since been interpreted also to limit the ability of states to interfere with free exercise rights and to establish religion.
So we have the free exercise of religion, although that's been debated and interpreted, and that's what we'll talk about.
Sure.
But we also have a rule saying that the government cannot favor any one religion over another.
That's right. And there's an inherent tension there because depending on how you characterize the issue, for example, if a government entity declines to make its facilities available to a religious group, those who would like access to those facilities might say that that's an interference. That's a discrimination against religion, and that interferes with free exercise rights. On the other hand, those defending the decision might say that is maintaining that wall of separation between church and state. So we have historically had lots of battles and disagreements about how to bring, to operationalize both the promise of a right to free exercise and the promise of a right to be free from a religious establishment.
Are there other amendments, John, in the Constitution that also touch on this issue, or is the First Amendment pretty much it?
No. Well, there's also tension between the guarantee in the 14th Amendment of equal protection of the laws and various statutes that have been enacted to, you know, operationalize that promise. Because, of course, many religions take strong moral positions. Let's just take the most obvious example with respect to same-sex marriage. Many religions would teach that same-sex marriage is wrong, and yet there are many in the country today who would argue that denying a marriage license to a couple on the basis of sexual orientation is a discrimination that violates the Equal Protection Guarantee. So there's inherent tension within the Constitution itself between the free exercise right and other rights that are protected.
And even though, John, you know, this is coming up recently with the Affordable Care Act, contraception coverage, you know, prayer in public places has always been there, and we're talking about gay marriage, and it's come up that way. This has come up with other issues in the past, right? I mean, this is nothing new.
Oh, no. Yeah, this, you know, it feels like it's coming to a crescendo right now, but this is an issue that has always been with us.
Yeah. Hiram, what do you think? What are some of the key issues where religious freedom has been invoked in the past? Give us one or two of your favorite examples.
Well, I think one of the best examples of religious liberty is the Galloway decision that was actually came down from the U.S. Supreme Court just recently, in which the town of Greece said that they wanted to open up their town meetings, their city council meetings, with a prayer, something that many cities and counties, school districts, state legislatures, and Congress has been doing for a couple of centuries. And they were sued because the prayers were too Christian. There was too much Jesus going on. And the Supreme Court ruled in a 5-4 decision that, in fact, it's perfectly okay to have these types of prayers. Even if there's too much Jesus, it's still okay. And I think really why that decision is important and why it highlights a historical tension here is that because, you know, the folks who were praying were pastors that were sort of randomly selected or selected based upon, you know, their standing in the community, not particularly what they would say. But when they would get up there to say whatever it is they wanted to say, it was not appropriate for the government to try to go in and try to secularize their prayer, to say, hey, look, don't say Jesus, okay? You know, so the pastors have the freedom to pray. And having that little prayer beforehand is not an establishment of religion. So it's sort of a nice example that encapsulates the progression of these two pillars of our Constitution.
So, and I want to get you in this too, Gilles. But so you feel with the majority, Hiram, that this was not an establishment of religion by a governmental entity. What would be an establishment?
Well, I think it's what they understood to be an establishment, which is here the official church for New Hampshire is going to be the Anglican Church, we're gonna support it with taxpayer money. We're gonna hire the pastors. They're gonna be beholden to the government. I mean, that's what our founding fathers thought establishing a religion was. They did not see it as, oh, we prayed beforehand, because they did. They prayed while they were passing before they passed the First Amendment. Right after passing the First Amendment, the Congress authorized the printing of Bibles, which says on their second page, to be used in our nation's schools. So these little things here are not establishing religion. Establishing religion was really the European model of this is the official Church of England.
What do you think, Gilles, since we're diving into this case? Hiram's saying, look, you got to go a lot further than a short prayer before a public meeting before you've got a government-established religion.
Sure, and I think it's important to distinguish between religious liberty and religious freedom and the Establishment Clause. So the City of Greece case was an Establishment Clause case where the court was basically trying to ascertain whether or not the government, through the individual board members endorsing religion, so to speak, was establishing religion for the purposes of the City of Greece. And so I think what's different, that's fundamentally different than religious liberty, right? I don't think anyone's really disputing the notion that the individual board members of the City of Greece could exercise their religion on their own time. They're certainly free to go to church. They're free within their home to practice their religion as they see fit. And they're certainly free in the public square to promote and publicly speak about their religion. But City of Greece is a little different, right? It has to do with government actors in a public space where the public is engaging government actors. As to whether or not that conduct was kind of so coercive that the Establishment Clause was being violated. And I think it's important to differentiate those two principles because the ACLU, frankly, for over 100 years has been fighting for the rights of conscience and religious liberty. And today our commitment is just as strong as ever. And, you know, we're dealing with religious liberty cases all the time. You know, currently we're helping mosques fight discriminatory zoning practices in Kentucky. We're imposing school bans on Catholic rosaries in Virginia, Texas, and Nebraska. And I think one of the things we'll get to, a little bit later is where does free exercise kind of rub up against the compelling governmental interest in preventing discrimination? And I think discrimination is an aspect of both the Hobby Lobby case with respect to gender discrimination and remedying gender inequity.
I definitely want to talk about that. But one more quick question for you, Gilles, on this Greece-New York case. So how did you feel about how the majority voted in this case that it was okay to open up these public meetings with a almost all the time Christian prayer.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we're disappointed with the decision. And I think, you know, the ACLU is of the belief that official religious favoritism should be off limits. And, you know, I would recommend anyone who's interested in this case to look at Justice Kagan's opinion and or dissent in that case. And one of the things that she said that really struck a chord with me was that the town of Greece's prayer practices violate the norm of religious equality, the breathtakingly generous constitutional idea, this is her words, that our public institutions belong no less to the Buddhist or Hindu than the Methodist or Episcopalian. And so, you know, one of the things that she was really concerned about was two things. One was just the act of prayer itself in these public meetings. The individual who was providing the prayer service had his back in many instances to the board officials and had instead was facing the actual members of the public, in essence proselytizing to them about Jesus Christ and the Christian faith. In many instances was asking individuals in the crowd to actually stand up, and in some instances even was actually performing the cross with his or her hands. And so Justice Kagan was profoundly concerned about that, right? She was really concerned about how this could have a coercive impact on individuals who were at these board meetings, not just to watch the proceedings, but to engage board members, to ask them to do things for the public or for themselves. And it put individuals, I think, in Justice Kagan's belief, in a very difficult position if you don't subscribe to those beliefs. Do you stand up and adopt these religious views if you disagree with them? Or do you sit down and, in essence, you know, show your dissent tacitly? And how could that, you know, there's concern, obviously, among those individuals that it could impact their ability to engage board officials and could impact the decision-making of the board officials if they're dissenting.
Let me invite our listeners to join us, and then we have a lot more to talk about, gentlemen. The number here on the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page if you like. It's NHPR Exchange, all one word. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. In just a moment, let's get your questions, thoughts, and comments on how we define religious freedom these days and whether our views are changing on this issue. We'll hear from you in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio. It's 9:19. Good morning. You can make sure your membership gift to NHPR goes as far as it can with our corporate match program. Many businesses around the state match their employees' donations to NHPR. You can essentially double the impact of your membership gift. Find out if your company participates at nhpr.org. More on religious freedom back in the news on The Exchange at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, the 60th anniversary of Brown versus Board of Education, the history of the landmark decision. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and Kentucky River Canoe Company of Concord, hosting an on-water demo day May 18th with over 200 kayaks, canoes, and stand-up paddle boards to try. KentuckyCanoe.com. From Parkland Medical Center, Dairy, helping you take control of your family's health by providing answers to medical questions anytime, anywhere. iTriageHealth.com. And New Hampshire Business Review, for more than 36 years, a Granite State source for business news, analysis, and commentary, with breaking business news at nhbr.com.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the renewed national debate over religious freedom and what we mean by that. We're looking at several instances where this has come up recently, including a recent case from a town in New York where prayer was done before public meetings. There was a court case about that recently decided in favor of town officials. The phone number here in The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. And gentlemen, before we turn to the Hobby Lobby case, which a lot of people mentioned earlier, this is the case concerning contraception and whether that should be mandated under the Affordable Care Act. One more question, John Grabe, about prayer in public places, separation of church and state. Is prayer in public schools allowed in any way, shape, or form anymore? I mean, that's another big public space.
That's right. No, there is no prayer is allowed in public schools. We've always thought of the legislative context, beginning a legislative session or a quasi-legislative section, session such as what was at issue in the Town of Greece case. We've always thought of that as different. And the reason why it's permitted is history. Historically, we have always understood that that was a permissible act, notwithstanding the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment.
All right. Let's take some calls, gentlemen. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Mike's joining us from Dover. Hi, Mike. You're on the air. Thanks for calling The Exchange.
Thanks. I really do appreciate this this topic. I did get to listen to the oral arguments on the Supreme Court website, and I'm generally in favor of the decision for the Greece case. And the reason why is after listening to the arguments, there seemed to be a couple of different points that I'd like to point out. One is the difference between freedom of religion and freedom from religion. I think that was a big point that was established inside the case. The other point, which the people who are bringing this case against Greece definitely acknowledged, was the fact that the ceremony was totally separate from the board meeting, and that they did kind of say, you know what, this is a legislative body. I mean, Congress opens up with a prayer all the time. And so I kind of wanted to point out those two things and really kind of see where the guests that you have are when it comes to those two things, basically freedom of religion and freedom from religion, and whether or not they make those distinctions at all.
Okay, Mike, thank you very much. And Hiram, I'll turn to you first. Go ahead.
Yeah, you know, I think what a great example for people of New Hampshire to take a hold of and look at is Governor John Langdon, one of our original founding fathers, governor of New Hampshire. In his proclamation that he issued on October 10th, 1805, he said that in praising and adoring Almighty God and in offering up our thanks to Him as the great author of every good and perfect gift. And then he went on to get really, you know, kind of gospel-esque here. He said, but above all, for the inestimable blessings of the gospel of peace and salvation, the means of grace and hope of future glory through the merits of a crucified Savior. This is an acknowledgement of religion, government acknowledgement of religion is a longstanding practice in this country. It's been around for a very, very long time, since the very beginning, obviously. And even in New Hampshire, there's strong precedent for that. And no one viewed that as establishing a church or religion. I think religious acknowledgement is a very different thing than establishment. And I think that's why the Town of Greece case turned out the way it did and should have. And probably through real historical analysis and practice, there probably should be some other cases and other issues that should be revisited that have been sort of tortured by the Supreme Court over the years, including some of the other Establishment Clause decisions. Because I think in historical practice, if we look at what our country was founded upon and what they believed when they were writing the Constitution, acknowledgement of religion was not a big deal.
Actually, let me follow up on what you said, Hiram. That's interesting, and ask you, Gilles. Hiram says religious acknowledgement is different from establishment. The union leader also editorialized about this case, saying, if atheists are so sensitive that they cannot stand to even hear other citizens recite the Lord's name, that's a shame. But the union leader said, hypersensitivity does not create a legal justification for purging any mention of God from public places. What do you think? Religious acknowledgement is not establishment.
Sure. And I think, you know, again, what we're dealing with here are government officials acting, as state actors, espousing certain religious views. I mean, this isn't a scenario where an individual's walking down a sidewalk and hearing religious speech and is offended. Of course, you know, you're going to hear speech walking down a sidewalk that you may agree or disagree with. What we're dealing with here is a scenario where government actors, again, are engaging in certain religious conduct. And, you know, I think what really the dissent was concerned about was the fact that, citizens are going before the city of Greece. They're asking for certain business to be conducted. They're asking for certain relief from government officials. And, you know, in so doing, they could very well feel coerced to actually participate in religious practice.
They don't want to be seen as difficult, given that they're making their case before town officials.
And in fact, to address the caller's point, Justice Kagan was very concerned. Well, she didn't really buy that the prayers were separate from the actual board action. She actually thought they were far more integrated. And in fact, as I said before, prior to many of these prayers, the members of the audience were asked to actually participate, and stand up. And I would note just one last point. The court didn't just solely rely on historical practice. It didn't say simply because this has been done in the past, it could be done in the future, and there are no limits. And in fact, there are some limits. The court said if the course and practice over time shows that the invocations denigrate nonbelievers or religious minorities, threaten damnation, or preach conversion, that would be a different matter. So, there may be some cases in the future that address that standard.
So if the prayer says, all Muslims in this audience are unwelcome and you're in big trouble, that would be different.
Sure,
then.
I think so.
All right. Well, let's move to the Hobby Lobby case. Thank you, by the way, Mike, for that call, because this has not been decided yet, John Graby, but it certainly has been tied up with this issue of religious freedom that we're talking about. Just remind us what this is about and what the fundamental constitutional arguments are here.
Sure. Hobby Lobby is a craft company that is owned by a family, a very religious family. Hobby Lobby provides health insurance to its employees. Under the Affordable Care Act, there are 20 forms of birth control that are to be covered under health insurance policies that are offered in the employment context. Hobby Lobby and the owners of Hobby Lobby object to 4 of those 20 forms of contraceptives.
So not all of them.
Not all of them. They object to, as I understand it, 2 morning after pills and 2 IUDs that prevent the implantation of an already fertilized egg. And they take the position that under their religious beliefs, those devices cause abortions. And they say that their religious rights should preclude them from having to make those available to their employees. So they are objecting to the application of the mandate to cover all 20 of these contraceptive services. They're saying that their religious beliefs should exempt them from doing so. They are making a claim under the First Amendment, but their principal argument is actually under a federal statute known as the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which it was passed in 1993 and which says that under federal law, conscientious religious objection should preclude someone from having to comply with other federal laws unless the government establishes a compelling interest in making people set their religious views aside.
Well, so a higher threshold for the government before it can say, no, you have to do this.
That's right. It's a federal law that basically says when it comes to other laws that we've passed, we don't want those laws to apply to people in situations where it interferes with their religious beliefs, unless there's a very, very strong interest in forcing them to set their religious beliefs aside.
So I want to ask you about this, Hiram, and some of the disagreement that's come up around this. Some people have said, hey, if the court agrees with Hobby Lobby, then anybody can claim anything and say that it offends their religious belief, that you're just opening up too big a box there. What do you think?
Well, I agree with Senator Ted Kennedy, who was the godfather of establishing that federal statute that we just talked about, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, in that this is a law that expands religious liberty in an appropriate way, but also has the appropriate safeguards, such that if the government has a compelling interest to restrict religious liberty in some way, and that restriction would be done through the least restrictive means, then the government has the power to do that. So the normal things that you would think of, all the parade of horribles you could think of in terms of trying to create examples of, well, what if somebody did this, those would probably all be able to be regulated or prohibited by the government under the standard of the statute that Ted Kennedy put together for us.
Ted Kennedy put together this statute, again, that John Graby mentioned, signed by Bill Clinton in 1993. Is this going to be invoked more and more often as the Affordable Care Act really goes into full effect, Hiram? What do you think?
Well, I think that the Religious Freedom Restoration Act is an important tool for advancing religious liberty. I think that it's important for people to understand that the government is not all-encompassing in power. that people have individual freedom. They have rights, and that those rights include religious liberty. And in fact, in the Constitution, it's the first liberty that's mentioned in the Bill of Rights is religious liberty. And so I think it's just important for religious liberty to continue to thrive, because I think historically we found that religious liberty is sort of the beginning and the wellspring for all liberty. And when the government can restrict religious liberty, there's a lot of other liberties that they can also begin to restrict.
Gilles, I'm sure you've got some thoughts on this, but I want to go to a couple calls. The number here in the exchange again is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. John's waiting in Nashua. Hi, John, you're on the exchange. Thanks for joining us.
Morning, everybody.
Morning.
I was calling regarding this case. I wanted to ask, specifically for the healthcare question, if the court finds that Hobby Lobby does have a right to restrict coverage for contraception, for those four forms of contraception, what's to prevent a Christian Scientist who owns a company from saying, I don't want my employees to see a doctor at all? Or I don't mean to, overgeneralize or anything, but Jehovah's Witness to say, I don't want blood transfusions or operations requiring blood transfusions to be covered because it goes against my religion. I feel like the rights of the women, might need to take precedence here over the rights of a corporation.
Okay, thank you very much for calling in, John. And think to you next, Gilles. What do you think? He's expressing this concern that if the court goes with Hobby Lobby's point of view, you are going to open up a big box.
Yeah, no, I think he makes a great point. And, for example, there are religions that specifically don't allow, their adherents to receive vaccines, blood transfusions, surgery, certain prescription drugs, mental health care, and the like. So if Hobby Lobby is successful...
Mental health care, really?
So if Hobby Lobby is successful, religious companies that subscribe to these views very well may be able to opt out of insurance plans that provide for these critical services. And so I think going back to Hiram's point, though, I think it's critical to note that this is almost not the traditional Religious Freedom Restoration Act case. The Hobby Lobby case threatens to transform RFRA from a shield to protect against substantial burdens on religious exercise, to a sword that allows business owners to impose their beliefs on others. When RFRA was debated back in 1993, Congress didn't consider any examples of imposing burdens on third parties. And the third party here, of course, is women.
RFRA, again, is the Religious Freedom Restoration Act.
Sorry.
That's okay.
Because really the goal behind the birth control benefit in the Affordable Care Act was to provide women with equal access to recommended healthcare services. And until the ACA was passed, there was tremendous disparity in the out-of-pocket costs women were paying versus the costs men were paying.
Hiram, I want you to jump in on this concern that our caller raises, that all sorts of religious objections could come up under health insurance. And then, John Grabe, I've got another question for you, too. Go ahead, Hiram, please.
Well, sure. Well, the law is set up so that each case can be analyzed under the specific merits of the facts that pertain to that issue. So the Hobby Lobby case dealing with just the fact that they don't want to actually just pay for the company, does not want to pay for coverage for four out of the 20 available methods of contraception, that's a very different issue than maybe another business who would want to pay for coverage of some other type, and they would have to be analyzed as to what the alternatives are, what are the costs and the benefits, and you just have to run that through the compelling interest test and the least restrictive means component of that sort of strict scrutiny package. But at the one of the things that I find very interesting is that Gilles' reaction to that paying for something, that Hobby Lobby paying for something that they have a religious objection to, is sort of no big deal for Hobby Lobby, because the ACLU has long fought that if taxpayers are using money, that taxpayer money is being used to pay for certain religious activities, that that's a great offense to the person who's doing the paying, the taxpayer. So I don't understand why they can sympathize with the taxpayer saying, my money's being used for something with which I disagree, and then not sympathize with Hobby Lobby saying, I don't want to spend my money on something I find violates my religious faith and I find morally wrong.
I'll give you a quick chance to respond there, Gilles, and then, John, I do want to ask you a question about whether a company like Hobby Lobby is the same as an individual who has religious liberty. But super quick, Gilles,
yeah,
if you could.
I hope we get to that, because I think, you know, one of the fundamental issues in this case, right, is whether or not there's actually a substantial burden on Hobby Lobby's practice of religion. And I just want to be very clear. I mean, Hobby Lobby, since it's a company here and not a person, isn't, of course, required to actually use or endorse contraception. You know, Hobby Lobby and its owners can still oppose and speak out publicly against contraception. And I think this is the most important part here, that the actual use of contraception in this case is based on the independent private decision of a female employee who possesses her own rights to religious liberty and autonomy. And I don't think.
But Hobby Lobby is paying for it if it's providing her coverage.
Well, but the decision, though, ultimately at the end of the day, is made by the woman. And I don't really see how this would be any different, frankly, than Hobby Lobby paying wages to a woman, and then that woman then, and you know, ultimately using contraceptive care that Hobby Lobby would ultimately be opposed to. I mean, I don't really see a fundamental difference there.
John, I do want to ask you about this issue of is a corporation the same as a person? And most people would say, okay, people have some measure of religious liberty. What about a corporation?
Well, a corporation, legally speaking, is a legal person. But that's the big question in this case. That's actually the specific issue raised in Hobby Lobby, which is whether under this federal statute, which protects the rights of people to freely exercise their religion, except in the event of a compelling government interest, whether or not a corporate entity such as Hobby Lobby should also have that protection. And that's an issue that's arisen in a couple of different contexts in recent cases. Of course, a few years ago in the Citizens United case, the Supreme Court held that another provision of the First Amendment, the Free Speech Clause, was applicable in the corporate context, and that corporations and labor unions do have free speech rights in the context of contributing money to political campaigns. So this question seems to be recurring, the individual constitutional rights of corporations. Now, in a number of contexts, we've recognized that corporations have constitutional rights. That's not new, but it's something, it's an issue that seems to be coming to the fore with greater frequency in recent years.
All right. Well, more conversation after a short break. We'll take a lot more of your calls, Facebook comments, emails, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. More conversation about religious freedom, how we define it these days in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the 60th anniversary of Brown versus Board of Education, the history of the landmark decision, then a discussion of the ruling's legacy in racial integration in schools today. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
This morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from the New Hampshire Trust Company, a locally owned and managed firm providing trust and investment management services throughout New Hampshire, online at nhtrustco.com. And Vineyard Brands, importers of Marcus de Caceres wines from the Rioja region of northern Spain. Information on the web at vineyardbrands.com. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the renewed national debate over religious freedom, what we mean by that, how it's come up recently in two U.S. Supreme Court cases and in a plethora of state legislative debates. Let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. What's your take on these most recent debates that we've been talking about, whether it's the prayer before public meetings or concerns by the Hobby Lobby company over contraceptive coverage? And do you see the country country's views changing on this issue of religious freedom? Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Hiram Sasser, John Graby, Gilles Bissonnette, let's go back to our callers. And William joins us from Concord. Hi, William. Go ahead. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Thank you. So my point is, I'm a practicing Catholic, and I worked for years at Catholic Medical Center in Manchester. And Catholic Medical Center, of all the hospitals in New Hampshire, gives out more free care to people who come into the ER and for services there. And yet at the same time, I'm angry because the federal government under ACA says that we're going to fine you if you don't start providing contraceptive coverage to your employees. But at the same time, our beliefs about contraceptive goes to the very heart of our teachings about the sanctity of life. So I think it's very unfair of the government to insist that we do this. And it's all the more reason because we're providing so many services free to the public who come to the ER.
So, William, is CMC going to ask for some sort of exception, or is it going to pay the
fine? You know, I'm not sure where they stand on this, but I know that there are several Catholic institutions, including universities, that have filed suit to the federal government about this very issue. So I'm not sure where CMC is. I'm not an employee of there right now, but I was up until recently.
Okay, William, thank you very much for calling in. Let's hear from everybody on this. Gilles, you want to go first?
Sure. I think it's important to note that the Hobby Lobby case actually has to do with a for-profit corporation and not religious institutions or nonprofit religious institutions, which are actually exempted under the ACA birth control benefit.
So a nonprofit Catholic hospital is exempt from this.
Yeah, they are. So going back to John's point before, I think it kind of raises the interesting question as to how for-profit corporations should be treated under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And without getting into kind of the threshold question as to whether or not a corporation is actually a person under RFRA, I think the fact that we're dealing with a corporation kind of influences the substantive analysis under RFRA, that is, whether or not a corporation can have its religious views substantially burdened. And I think, you know, I think it makes it harder when you're dealing with a corporation. You know, one way to think about a company is that it's a distinct legal entity that's different from the rights, of the individuals who created it and who own it. I mean, one of the benefits of corporate ownership is limited liability. That is, owners are separate and apart from the company, and the owners can't be liable for the acts and responsibilities of the corporation. So I think what's interesting about the Hobby Lobby case is you have the individual religious views of the owners, in essence, being foisted upon the company, right? And then the company is reusing those religious views to then, not purchase certain contraception coverage that many women need, including poor women.
Do you want to jump in, John Graby? And Hiram, I want to hear from you, too, about the issues concerning a Catholic entity like CMC and where it falls in terms of this.
Well, my understanding is the same as Gilles, is that we've already made a distinction. We've already exempted certain nonprofits and religious organizations from having to comply with provisions of the Affordable Care Act to which they have interposed a religious objection. The issue at the heart of this case is really an issue of statutory interpretation. This was a federal statute enacted by Congress in 1993. And at bottom, what the court needs to decide is when Congress enacted this provision, certainly it had in mind human beings as the prototypical beneficiaries. But the question is, would it also have wanted the statute to cover corporate entities, corporate people?
Yeah, well, here's another side of this issue that our caller raises. And thank you very much for calling in, because CMC is a large, important faith-based entity in our state. Hiram, this is for you. So could a female employee at Catholic Medical Center say, hey, CMC, other hospitals are providing contraceptive coverage for their employees. I want that coverage, too. Would she have a legal standing there?
Well, this is where I'm going to disagree with the other two distinguished members of our panel here, because Notre Dame had asked for an exemption and fought for an exemption, and they lost. They actually lost their case. They're having to require. They're having to provide that contraception coverage. The Little Sisters of the Poor had to fight all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court to get an exemption from having to provide this kind of coverage. Not all religious nonprofits were exempt from the very narrow rules that were passed by this administration. So that, just to put that issue to the side, this hospital could very well find itself on the side of the ledger of Notre Dame rather than some of the other religious nonprofits that have been able to fight in court tooth and nail to be able to get their exemption. But just to the point of the corporate entity, I think that if the Supreme Court has said that the First Amendment protects the New York Times, a for-profit corporation, if the First Amendment protects Turner Broadcasting, a for-profit corporation, and the U.S. Supreme Court says the First Amendment protects the Playboy Entertainment Group, because of the, you know, protects their First Amendment rights to distribute pornography, then I think at the very least, the Supreme Court should also agree that Hobby Lobby should enjoy the same First Amendment protections and the same First Amendment deference as Playboy does.
One last quick point on this, and then I do want to turn to some of these laws in state legislatures concerning, again, private companies and whether they need to provide services to same-sex couples. This question is for you, Gilles. You know, it's a free country. If you don't like Hobby Lobby's policies concerning coverage, if you don't like CMC's policies, you know, work somewhere else.
Sure. But I think, you know, in answering that question, I think we do need to understand what the fundamental purpose of the Affordable Care Act was and how it was trying to, again, remedy this tremendous gender inequity that existed with respect to out-of-pocket costs. You know, so for example, women of childbearing age spend 68% more in healthcare costs than men. And so Congress acknowledged when it passed the Affordable Care Act that this inequity was inherently discriminatory because men, frankly, don't bear certain reproductive costs, right? That's obvious. You know, while many insurance companies are providing Viagra, you know, some of these very same insurance companies aren't providing IUDs, aren't providing for Plan B. And so this is really what the Affordable Care Act was trying to remedy, right? And these disproportionately high costs have a real impact on women, frankly. You know, women often find that co-payments and other cost sharing for important preventive services are so high that they avoid getting the services in the first place. And almost one-third of women in the U.S. report that they would change their contraceptive method, if cost weren't an issue. So, you know, I think, frankly, that there is a very compelling governmental interest in what the Affordable Care Act was trying to accomplish, and that was, frankly, prevent gender discrimination in the field of medical care costs and reproductive health.
All right, gentlemen, I don't want to let the show end without talking about some of these issues that have been happening in state legislatures. This made big headlines recently, John Graby, back in late February when Governor Jan Brewer of Arizona vetoed a bill that would have allowed private businesses not to extend services to same-sex couples. There was that baker in Colorado who kind of made national fame when he said, I don't want to bake a cake for a same-sex wedding. Just remind us what the legal basis is or the legal thinking is around these laws.
Well, just as we've talked for most of the show about this tension between the free exercise right of the First Amendment and the promise of no establishment of religion, there's also a tension between the free exercise right and certain laws which prevent discrimination because many people are members of religious faiths that teach that certain behavior, certain conduct, certain relationships are immoral, and they want to act on those beliefs. So they may not want to photograph the wedding, for example, of a same-sex couple. That is, I think, the issue that's going to be coming down the road. And a lot will depend on how broadly or narrowly the Hobby Lobby case is written. But if the court takes a very, very broad view of free exercise rights and related statutory rights in the Religious Freedom Act, it could put into question whether or not anti-discrimination laws that apply to businesses and other places of public accommodation should be applied to individuals and owners of businesses that have religious objections to serving certain customers.
So the Hobby Lobby case, even though that's about contraception coverage, John, is going to have implications for these state laws.
Well, it could. It could. It also could be written, and I actually think it is likely to be written on far narrower grounds. But
They like to do that, don't they? Everybody's hoping for a broad statement, and they just make this very narrow statement, and people are left scratching their heads.
There are at least, there's at least a majority of the justices on the court that prefer a minimalistic approach.
All right. Well, here's an email from, a Facebook comment from Deidre. She says, "It is a requirement as a business owner that I not discriminate against anyone, regardless of race, religion, etc. Some businesses are asking to discriminate against LGBT people based on religious grounds." Deidre says, "Why should we not be permitted as business owners with the same reasoning to discriminate against Christians?" Deidre says, "As a pagan, I could certainly make the claim that working with people who believe I worship Satan is an offense against my faith. This is truly a box after the fashion of Pandora." She says, "It's not about religion. It's about legitimizing bigotry." And Deidre, by the way, mentions she's a pagan minister and a member of the LGBT community. What do you think about this, Hiram, that this is legitimizing bigotry?
Well, I think the most important thing to realize is that the root of these laws protecting religious liberty, not so much in Arizona, that was a different type of language than some of the language we've advanced across the nation. But the language we've advanced is based primarily upon Senator Ted Kennedy's good language in the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, and the language that Bill Clinton approved of when he signed it into law, and the language that the ACLU endorsed and fought for, not only on the federal level, but on many state levels, for many state laws already on the books that protect religious liberty. And so I think that the most important thing is that people should be able to be out of the closet and be able to live their faith and be who they are in public without fear of reprimand or repercussion. I do think, though, it is very different it's a very different thing to say, look, I'm not going to, we're not going to serve certain people at Applebee's. I mean, I don't think Applebee's is ever going to be able to maintain some sort of religious liberty interest in not serving certain people. I don't think anyone's really debating that. But where the rubber meets the road are the people, the businesses that cater to weddings, like caterers or photographers, wedding planners, people who are intimately part of the actual process, the wedding process. And I don't think anyone's trying to debate the sort of the lunch counter issue. I think we do have a lot of people who want to say, look, I just don't want to participate in the actual ceremony. Is that okay? Is it okay if some other photographer does that I don't have to participate in that? And I don't think anyone should be forced to participate in something in an intimate way with which they have some sort of moral disagreement. I think that freedom applies to everybody, whether it's someone of faith or non-faith or whoever it would be.
So clear up for me, please, Hiram, what's okay and what isn't. So it should be okay for the baker to say, no, I don't want to make a cake for a same-sex wedding. But it's not okay for the waitress at the lunch counter to say to two men who might be holding hands, waiting to order lunch, it's not okay for her to say, I'm not going to serve you guys because I don't approve of your relationship.
That just hasn't really been a big debate. I mean, that just hasn't been. I just haven't seen those cases or those issues. It's not a case that Liberty Institute would take. It's not something that we would be interested in. We're interested in the wedding planners, the bakers, the caterers, the florists, people who have to be intimately involved in something with which they have a moral disagreement. I think that's the big issue there. And I think we just want to carve out just some small exception for those folks. And yet there's these very powerful forces fighting to say, no, you cannot, you have to participate. It's like we can't, no one can just say live and let live and to each his own. It's as if there's a forced, you must say this is good and okay in order for all of us to be happy. And I just don't think people should do that. I think people should be free to disagree.
Well, and I definitely want to ask you about that, Gilles, too. But one last question for you, Hiram. This has come up. Others have made this point. I'm not the only person to make this point. People used to say, I won't endorse your, black man, white woman wedding. Is that the same thing here?
No, it's not at all, because we had a civil war to fight over that issue, and at the end we had a very specific 13th Amendment to prohibit slavery, and the Supreme Court has expanded upon that to include the badges of slavery and that type of religious discrimination. Racial discrimination. And so I think that the Constitution itself already has a very specific provision that addresses that issue. And I think in our longstanding history of our nation of disputing that racial discrimination and fighting eventually a civil war in which hundreds of thousands died over that issue, I think we've put that issue to bed.
Well, and real quick to you, Gilles, because we're running out of time. What about the live and let live? You know, why push the Colorado baker who really just doesn't want to make this cake? Why push it?
Well, I think, you know, everyone is entitled to their own religious beliefs. But when you operate a business or you run a publicly funded social service agency that's open to the public and you avail yourself of, you know, your state's corporation laws, you know, those beliefs don't give you a right to discriminate. And that includes, frankly, against LGBT Americans. We have 30,000 LGBT Americans in New Hampshire, and that includes over 3,000 LGBT households. They need to be included, and not discriminated against in the state, period. And that includes, when religious liberty is used to justify it.
Real quick, John Graby, any thoughts on how this Hobby Lobby case might go? Everybody's waiting to see what the Supreme Court might go, just based on the arguments and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, I actually expect that it'll be a narrow statutory resolution, relatively narrow.
Just on this case.
Yeah, I don't think there'll be a broad pronouncement on the meaning of the First Amendment in this particular case.
Okay, John Graby, thank you as always. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.
Hiram Sasser, good to have you. Thank you for your time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Hiram Sasser, Director of Litigation at the Liberty Institute in Texas, and Gilles Bissonnette, good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Laura.
Gilles Bissonnette, Staff Attorney for the New Hampshire Civil Liberties Union. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our volunteer is Alan Cohen. Our intern is James Pouliot. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. A tragedy in the town of Brentwood leaves a police officer and his attacker dead, and a lot of unanswered questions. State lawmakers work on filling a budget hole now that two courts have found a key hospital tax unconstitutional. And New Hampshire celebrates the homecoming of American Idol finalist Alex Preston. Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio with the Diane Rehm Show next at 10 o'clock. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from Comcast Business, continuously investing to keep customers ahead of the technology curve. Comcast Business is built for business. More at business.comcast.com. And Littleton Regional Healthcare, where good health begins, serving the healthcare needs of individuals in northern New Hampshire and Vermont regions for over 100 years.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Steve Roberts of George Washington University, sitting in today for Diane Rehm. In the decades following the Civil War, many states enacted laws that required racial segregation of public facilities, restaurants, and schools. In the 1930s, the NAACP began to challenge these so-called Jim Crow laws in various states. Then, in